FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz, and today is April 30th, 2020. Well, you know what's going on in the world. You see that the world economy has basically seized up, but there is hope. There are countries where things are going better than in the United States, where they've reopened and life has resumed some semblance of normalcy. When do you think the United States is going to go back to normal? Will it ever? Why don't you tell us in an email? Email us kl@kerrylutz.com. kl@kerrylutz.com. Well, right now, we're really blessed to have somebody on who I respect a lot, a real original thinker, somebody who thinks beyond the current paradigm, thinks outside the envelope, and comes up with solutions, not just more problems, which is what most people do. I'm talking about Richard Duncan. Richard, your site is richardduncaneconomics.com. You've written books. You've got a special offer coming up on your newsletter and your site, which we'll say for the end, but we really appreciate your coming on. What do you think is going to be the outcome, the aftermath of the coronavirus pandemic and what I would call the coronavirus panic, in certainly in the Western world?
Well, Kerry, first of all, thank you very much for having me back on. So yes, what's going to happen? Well, everything depends, of course, on how long the virus lasts. If it goes away this summer and doesn't come back, that's one thing. On the other hand, if it comes back in the fall and is even worse and continues year after year, then we're talking about an entirely different world. But I live in Thailand, and here there's reason for optimism. The number of new cases is down to single digits every day now. And in total, there have only been less than 3,000 cases. And that's really miraculous because in January, Thailand literally had somewhere around 1 million Chinese tourists here at the peak of their the virus in China. So the fact that it didn't spread like wildfire is truly a miracle. And it must be that the virus doesn't like hot, sunny, humid weather. That must explain why it's not spreading so quickly and why it's dying down. So hopefully that will be the case in the United States as well, in the northern hemisphere. When it warms up there this summer, hopefully this virus will die out. Now, let's assume that that's the sort of scenario we're looking at, not a recurrent virus in the fall that does even more damage then. In that case scenario, I think we're going to look back on this as one of the greatest economic experiments of all time. So let me put this in a, if I can, have just a minute, let me put this in a framework through which I view the world and how the economy works. For decades now, credit growth has been the main driver of economic growth in the United States. And anytime credit grew by less than 2%, adjusted for inflation, between 1950 and 2009, the economy went into recession. And it didn't recover from recession until we had another big surge of credit growth. And of course, during those years, even between 1980 and 2007, total credit to GDP in the US, credit as a ratio of GDP or total debt to GDP, increased from 150% up to 370%. So it was the credit growth that was driving economic growth for decades. And if we didn't have credit growth, then we had a recession. So then 2008 hits and credit starts to contract and we start to go into a depression and the government responds with trillion-dollar budget deficits financed with trillions of dollars of paper money creation. So that it was we've seen government debt held by the public more than triple since then, from $6 trillion to well over $18 trillion held by the public. But still, even with that enormous surge in government debt, the total debt of the country was just barely growing more than 2% adjusted for inflation. So that was just right at the recession threshold. It wasn't enough credit growth to drive economic growth. So the Fed stepped in and drove up asset prices to create a wealth effect and drive up the economy, make the economy grow that way. The asset price inflation was a kind of supplement to the inadequate credit growth. And so that was the world we were living in before the virus struck. The global economy was driven by credit growth. And when that wasn't enough, the Fed jumped in and propped it up even more with asset price inflation. The world was floating on an ocean of credit. And all the asset prices move up and down according to how much credit growth there is. And if credit starts to contract, if it doesn't grow enough, the U.S. goes into recession. And if it contracts a little bit, it's a severe recession. If it contracts sharply, then we have a depression. So this virus was a horrible blow to this arrangement because, of course, people are going to be defaulting on their consumer loans and business loans, and credit is going to contract. And at the same time, asset prices started to crash. The stock market was down more than 30%. So it wasn't surprising that the Fed jumped in with all guns blazing and has done everything in its power to try to push back up asset prices quite successfully so far, and also to ensure that credit doesn't contract by literally buying practically anything that's offered to them, right down to junk bonds. So that's the framework through which I see the world. Now, what's the world going to look like after the virus? Well, it's going to be very interesting because this is truly a once-in-history experiment. Luckily for the United States, we are a very wealthy country. And if it's necessary for the government, I mean, the GDP is last year was roughly $22 trillion. So, and the government debt to GDP last year was roughly 110% of GDP. So in an extreme scenario where the government had, and I'm not saying this is likely, but even if the government had to spend another $22 trillion making sure the economy doesn't collapse into a Great Depression, then that would double the government debt to GDP up to 220%. Well, that's less than what Japan has already. Japan already has 250% government debt to GDP, and their world hasn't come to an end. They don't have hyperinflation. In fact, they can sell Japanese government bonds at 0% interest, 10-year bonds. Now, we're not going to have to spend $22 trillion, but we may, it looks like we'll have to spend, the government will have to spend $5 trillion, and maybe even $10 trillion is not out of the question. But if that's the case, then, well, so be it. That's just going to be the price we have to pay to keep the economy intact. After all, if we let the economy collapse without the government support, and small and medium-sized businesses go bankrupt, corporations go bankrupt, all the banks fail, then the government's budget deficit is going to explode anyway, because tax revenues would evaporate and government spending on social safety nets would explode. So the debt would become larger in any case. But we can afford to do this. If the debt ends up $5 to $10 trillion higher than it is, then, well, that's just the price we're going to have to pay. And the Fed, of course, is going to have to finance practically all of this new government debt through paper money creation. They have already expanded their total assets. In other words, the amount of money that they've created, they've expanded that by 52% over the last 6 weeks alone. So this is a truly extraordinary experiment. What if we get to the other side of this with, let's say, well, you pick the number, an extra $5 to $10 trillion of government debt and an extra $5 to $10 trillion of new paper money creation, and we don't end up with any inflation at the CPI level, and the world doesn't come to an end, then what should we learn from that? What lesson do we draw from that if that does, in fact, turn out to be the case?
That's a good question.
Well, the lesson I would draw from that is that we are living in a completely new economic environment, that we don't understand the economic environment we're living in. This, we still, most people who studied economics at university seem to still believe that we're living in some sort of 19th century environment where gold is money and trade between countries has to balance and every country is its own little domestic world without trade imbalances. But that's not the world we've been living in for decades. In the world we live in now, gold is not money. So the central banks are free to create as much paper money as they want. Traditionally, and if we were still in a world where trade between countries had to balance, then a lot of paper money creation would lead to high rates of inflation because it would overheat the domestic economy and lead to full employment and full capacity utilization. But when you have a global economy with 8 billion people, 2 billion of whom are happy to work for less than $10 a day, very happy, then we're living in a completely different environment and an economic system than we think we are. Because what we've seen in the 12 years between 2008 and the start of this virus crisis is that the government did expand its debt. It tripled its government debt and then some. And the Fed financed that by expanding the size of its balance sheet by five times between 2007 and 2014 when QE3 ended. And that didn't cause inflation then. The Fed's balance sheet expanded five times and we didn't get inflation at the CPI level then. Well, so now if the government were to, I mean, just throwing around some numbers, the government debt is above 20 trillion. What if they tripled it again? So that would be 60 trillion. And if the Fed expanded its balance sheet five times again, that would give the Fed an extra nearly $17 trillion of firepower to use to finance the expansion of government debt. So I'm just comparing how much the government debt would have to grow this time to match how much it grew in the crisis of 2008, and the same with the Fed's balance sheet. Those would be the sort of numbers we're looking at time, just to match what happened last time. And last time didn't cause any inflation. Oh. It didn't cause inflation because we had globalization. But now will globalization survive or globalization collapse? That is the most important question, perhaps, about how the future is going to look.
That's the $64 trillion question. And we could argue the merits of the CPI measurement and GDP, but we don't need to do that here. So the question is, we're going to survive one way or the other. But the concept of freedom, of your ability to pursue your own happiness, as outlined in the founding documents, at least the Declaration of Independence, pursuit of happiness was up there with life and liberty. That's taking a hit now, isn't it?
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next.
Trilogy Metals is a world-class developer in Alaska's Ambler Mining District. The company already possesses 8 billion pounds of copper, 3 billion pounds of zinc, over 1 million gold equivalent ounces, and now over 77 million pounds of cobalt. Trilogy's Arctic project boasts an after-tax net present value of $1.4 billion with a 33% IRR. Trilogy is led by an experienced management team with proven success in discovering and developing projects in Alaska. The company is well capitalized, has no debt, and possesses strong institutional support. Trilogy trades on the New York and Toronto exchanges under the ticker symbol TMQ. To learn more, go to trilogymetals.com. That's trilogymetals.com.
The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Well, I appreciated your introduction when you said that I'm someone who looks for solutions, because I really do. I mean, I really think that there's no point in saying we're all doomed and, you know, planning to live in the cave in the future. We really need to figure out the kind of economic system we're in, how it works, and make the most of it. Now, I really think that you can think of us as being a fish in a fishbowl that has been dropped into the ocean. What I mean by that is our domestic economy has been dropped into the global economy. And the constraints that confined us before, when we had a relatively small and closed domestic economy, no longer do. The environment in which we're operating is so much larger than it ever was because of globalization. All we have to do is realize that and swim out the top, and a world of infinite abundance perhaps awaits us. If it is in fact true that the government can spend trillions of dollars and finance it with trillions of dollars of paper money creation without creating high rates of inflation, then this opens up all kinds of opportunities for us to grow our economy and grow our productivity and grow out of all of the problems that so many people focus on exclusively. For instance, I mean, before the crisis started, I have made a number of Macro Watch videos arguing that the United States should, over the next 10 years, invest trillions of dollars in new industries and new technologies. Now, I haven't put a specific figure on that, but I've used the example of $10 trillion over 10 years. You know, have the government invest in cooperation with the private sector through joint ventures with private sector entrepreneurs. We could discuss that in more detail later if you'd want. Mm-hmm. But over a 10-year program, investing in the industries of the future, things like artificial intelligence, quantum computing, neural sciences, biotech, nanotech, genetic engineering, robotics, and all the other usual suspects. If we invested on that scale in these new industries and technologies, we could induce a new technological revolution that would radically improve productivity, radically make the economy expand, and along the way end up with technological breakthroughs and medical miracles. We could cure all the diseases with that kind of money. For example, the National Cancer Institute, its annual budget is $6 billion a year. Cancer kills 600,000 Americans every year. Well, what if we, instead of spending $6 billion a year trying to cure cancer, what if we spent $60 billion or $100 billion until we do? And then once we do and cure the other diseases along the way with this kind of investment, then we expand life expectancy by perhaps decades. And that cures all of our Social Security problems and our Medicare problems. If one of these joint venture companies between the government and the private sector comes up with a cancer vaccine, we'll list that on NASDAQ for $5 trillion, and this whole program pays for itself. So we're now looking at an extraordinary experiment. If we end up with $5 or $10 trillion of additional debt and $5 or $10 trillion of extra paper money creation and no serious amounts of inflation, then what we should learn from this is that we need to do more. We need to invest in our future in a very aggressive way, because otherwise we're going to very quickly be overtaken by China economically, technologically, and militarily. And we don't want to be there. China has already won the race to develop 5G. If China wins the race to develop artificial intelligence, then they own the future. Whichever country develops artificial general intelligence first, that's the point where machines can do anything humans can do. Then from there, it increases exponentially, and they control the world. It would be the 21st century equivalent of China having a nuclear monopoly.
Yeah.
There's no reason for us to sit back and allow that to happen. But that's exactly what we're doing at the moment. Last year, for the first time, China invested more in research and development than the United States did. And if current trends continue, by the end of this decade, they will invest 40% more in the year 2030 than the United States. And we will be just a second-rate, vulnerable, has-been power, completely vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate what you're saying, Richard, but is throwing money at problems, is that in fact the solution to solving them? Like, if we threw $60 billion at cancer research a year, no doubt the vast majority of it under our current system is going to fall into the wrong hands, and it's going to be lost to corruption.
I don't care how much of it is lost to corruption as long as we cure cancer and all the other diseases.
I mean, I agree with you there, but if the malinvestment that results from this, it does a lot more harm to other sectors. For instance, what's more important, curing cancer or getting rid of poverty? We've got a whole bunch of problems. Or getting rid of pollution, just as a for instance, or getting rid of traffic, which arguably kills more people than many other ailments out there. So if we could get rid of traffic, or how about if we come up with a way to reduce the overall stress of the population, is that worth $10 billion a year to throw into it? You know, that's the problem with government is they have their own agenda, and the money, just because they put it out there, isn't necessarily going to find its way. Look at the war on poverty. It's been a dismal failure. If we up that 10 times a year, is it going to be any more successful?
Well, so the choices that you listed, I think we could do all of those things simultaneously. I mean, the money we're talking about is not money that's coming out of taxes. It's money that the Fed is effectively creating. It has no cost attached to it. So if we can do this without causing inflation, because we now live in an enormous global environment rather than our previous environment, which was closed and domestic, then we should take advantage of this very aggressively. And investment on this scale would turbocharge economic growth. It would make the wealthy people enormously more wealthy, the middle class much more wealthy, and the poor would no longer be poor. Everyone would benefit, and for that matter, not only within the United States, but around the world. And in terms of the way that I envision this working, is the government could enter joint venture, it could act like a giant venture capital company. It raises the money from the Fed largely, and it sets up joint venture companies with the 10,000 most promising entrepreneurs. And the government funds these companies lavishly and gets to keep a 60% equity stake in them. And the entrepreneurs manage the companies and keep a 40% stake. And as I said, when these companies with this vast pool of money at their disposal starts curing all the diseases, and invent, you know, and ensuring our national security by keeping us ahead of China and all other comers, and ensure, you know, that would make sure that the first American century won't be the last.
All right. Well, hey, I love the fact that you are looking for solutions. I remember at one point, I think it was you talking about debt for equity swaps, things like that. Did you have something you thought about in those terms?
The only debt that I can recall is just discussing that the American taxpayers would keep 60% equity stakes in these companies that would be funded through quantitative easing, effectively.
Yeah. Okay. That's right. And well, it's an interesting perspective on things. It is an attempt to solve the problems. I guess, like you said, letting the free market work its magic kind of harkens back to the 19th century or the 20th century, early 20th century. We're kind of past that now, and maybe it's not viable, but maybe everything old becomes new again. I'm not sure, but we're going to think this through, and we're going to pose some questions to you in some emails and get your responses, and we'll publish them if that's okay.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, so the environment we're in is, of course, we're living in an enormous credit bubble. So what's our choice? Do we allow the credit bubble to pop, and like it did in the early 1930s, resulting in a 10-year depression that never ended until there was massive government spending during World War II? Financed with a lot of paper money creation. So the Depression never ended by itself. It was only massive government intervention and spending that ended that. Do we want to relive that? I mean, that's one option. I don't like that option. We avoided that option in 2008. If we let credit contract, then yeah, the doomsayers are right. We are doomed. But there's no reason to allow that to happen when the government can borrow money right now for 10 years at 60 basis points. And invest it in new industries and technologies with the best scientists and entrepreneurs in the world to manage it. So that's the way forward. That's the way out. We can grow out of this crisis, and we can remain the dominant global superpower indefinitely.
So let me give you an example here. We've got Elon Musk. Now, in my opinion, he is like one of the great thinkers. Maybe he's the Steve Jobs of the present time. But for everyone who believes that, there's another person on the other side who believes that he's a charlatan and a con man and a scammer and a modern day veritable P.T. Barnum. So whose view prevails here? Do we give this guy $50 billion to go solve the world's traffic problems and have rockets to Mars, et cetera? Or do we cut this guy off and prosecute him? You know, we've got these divergent views. I personally think he's a showman for sure. You could say that about our president as well, but I think he's done a lot of things. There's a lot of substance there. But my view isn't the only view out there. How do we handle an Elon Musk who arguably could be the greatest mind of our time and able to solve many of these problems?
Right. So I think, you know, set up companies with the most promising potential entrepreneurs. And if some of them turn out to be insane and lose every last cent, I mean, before this virus crisis started, I ran the numbers. And based on projections for government debt into the future, if we had spent an additional $10 trillion over 10 years, that would only have taken U.S. government debt up to 145% of GDP, assuming that every last cent was wasted and that not one single good thing came from American scientists and entrepreneurs investing $10 trillion, which of course is entirely impossible. But in a worst case scenario, it wouldn't have done any significant harm to the economy. So if 90% of these people steal the money and run away to, you know, wherever they want to run away to, and the other 10% cure all the diseases and make sure that the United States has national security and remains the dominant superpower for the next century, then I'm all for that bargain. I don't care if 90% is stolen. I don't care if 95% is entirely wasted. If the last 5% does the job, then that's all we need.
All right.
We will live a lot longer.
We could say that this is the spam theory of economics. The more you throw against the wall, hopefully the more that's going to stick. And don't get me wrong, I'm not belittling your views here, because I totally understand where you're coming from.
And you got to keep in mind the spam is entirely free.
But is there a free spam lunch? The classical economists would say no, because we have crowding out.
We don't have crowding out, though. Yeah. Look what happened in 2008. There was no crowding out. Mm. Interest rates fell.
Well, there's a tipping point.
There was only crowding out when money was pegged to gold. Then if the government borrowed too much, since there was a limited supply of money, then it pushed up interest rates and crowded out the private sector. But the world we live in now, is the thing that determines interest rates is not only the demand for money, but also the supply for money and where the demand and supply for money intersect. And with the Fed creating money, there's no crowding out.
Yeah, it's interesting.
As long as globalization persists, though, that's the key. If globalization breaks down, then everything that I've described is no longer possible. Because globalization is the reason that we haven't had very high rates of inflation, despite the massive surge in government debt and the massive increase in paper money creation. Right. And it's not certain that globalization is going to survive. The tensions between the United States and China were already very high. Mm. We more or less, the Cold War had already begun before this virus started. And now things are certainly much worse.
Yes.
And it's clear that the United States does need to bring back a significant amount of its manufacturing capacity. We've discovered now that we can't even manufacture our own surgical mask or
antibiotics and anything.
Or medicine.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And so
some of it has to come back. But if globalization completely collapses, then we'll be back in the environment we were in the 1960s and 70s, where too much government money printing and spending leads to double-digit inflation.
Agreed.
But we're probably not going to go back to that point where globalization completely breaks down, but we're not going to be back where we were 5 years ago either.
Midpoint.
Where we end up along this spectrum of no globalization or complete globalization is going to determine how high interest rate, how much inflation we get during the years ahead once the initial deflationary collapse passes.
Right. All right. Well, we've kind of run out of time, but you've got a special offer to FSN community members. Why don't you tell us what we've got here, Richard?
Yeah, thank you very much. So my business now is I produce a video newsletter called Macro Watch. And in it, I discuss developments in the global economy and how they impact asset prices. Every couple of weeks, I upload a new video. So if your listeners would like to check it out, they can find it at my website, richardduncaneconomics.com. And if they'd like to subscribe to MacroWatch, I'd like to offer them a 50% subscription discount. If they hit the subscribe tab, and then they'll be prompted for a discount coupon code. If they put in the word FACTS, F-A-C-T-S, they can subscribe to MacroWatch at a 50% discount. Or at the very least, sign up for my free blog there at richardduncaneconomics.com.
Okay. All right. And we put the discount code in the show notes to this interview. I urge all of you to take a look at what Richard has to say. He's one of the most forward-thinking people, critical thinkers, and independent minds. You'll definitely not find Richard with the lemmings going off the cliff, for sure. And Richard, we really appreciate you coming on. Any questions or comments, I'll direct them to Richard, kl@carrylutz.com. That is the email address. Make sure you visit our site, financialsurvivalnetwork.com, and get our newsletter. Richard, we will talk to you again. Thank you so much for coming on.
Carry, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure talking with you.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.